Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Friday, July 23rd, and I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, Room to Grow, the story by Gage Miskimen. Darius and Weli Nupolo dream of having more land to grow more food. The married couple farms their acre of land at Dow's farm every morning before they head to their full-time jobs. The work on the farm, however, is the dream they have been pursuing since before arriving in the United States over 5 years ago. Emigrating from Liberia in 2015, the two are farmers taking part in the Equitable Land Access Program, a partnership between Linn County and Feed Iowa First. The program, which is in its first year, connects people who have a background in agriculture but no land with the fertile fields along Dow's Road east of Cedar Rapids. Currently, two farmers each have an acre of land to grow what they want, however they want, through the program. Other farmers are growing conventional crops on the roughly 100 acres at Dow's farm. "We help them get started with equipment and things like that," said Feed Iowa First Executive Director Carter Oswood, "but we don't tell them what tools they use or need." The farmers then are able to sell the crops they grow and harvest for profit, increasing the amount of and access to locally grown food in Linn County, Osgood said. Dow's farm is 179 county-owned acres of farmland, pasture, and stream buffer, bordered by Mount Vernon and Dow's roads. In the future, it also will be the site of an agri-community that mixes housing with farming. When complete, half the property will be conservation land, 25% will be the farm's operation, and the remaining 25% will be the agri-community. Darius, age 43, who has a bachelor's degree in agriculture from the University of Liberia and a master's of strategic leadership from Mount Mercy University, uses no machinery in his farming practices. He farms using hand tools like shovels, rakes, and hoes. He said his interest in farming came from growing up on his dad's farm in the West African country. "I decided to learn it to improve the life of my family, and now I'm able to ascend to other people," Darius said. He applied to take part in the Equitable Land Program, which was at no cost other than a deposit that is given back at the end of the season. Currently, the Nupolos, with some help from their three children, are growing rows of tomatoes, bell peppers, ghost chilies, okra, onion, eggplant, and various African crops, including bitterball and water greens. Darius said his farming methods are organic. When the family moved to Iowa City in 2017, Darius said he observed a lot of Africans in the Cedar Rapids area, making the four-hour drive to Minneapolis to buy some of the same African foods that he now grows. "I thought we could try to do something," he said. "Instead of driving, we can produce these things here." So every day, Darius and Weli, age 35, farm from 7 a.m. to about 1 p.m. Then they head to their full-time jobs at Nordstrom Direct. "We come here every day and do this all by hand," Weli said. "Our goal is to get more land to grow more food." Oswood said the program's first year has proved to be viable, and next year the program will help Darius and Weli establish their own company. "Consistency is our motto," Darius said. "Anything you plan to do, you have to be consistent in it. Dedication is the only way to succeed. This has been my dream." Also on the front page of the Gazette today, 40 Iowans potentially exposed to a rabid bat at the Omaha Zoo. This story by Michaela Ram. 40 Iowans, including some from the Cedar Rapids area, had to undergo treatment for rabies after they potentially were in contact with a rabid bat at a zoo in Omaha. More than 180 individuals were advised to receive the rabies post-exposure prophylaxis, which contains the rabies vaccine, after a wild bat was found near a person attending one of the Henry Dorley Zoo's multiple overnight campouts at the aquarium earlier this month. A total of 186 overnight campers, including youth and adult groups, were contacted by the Nebraska Public Health Department, the Omaha World Herald reported. Among those were dozens of Iowans, mostly adolescents and their parents, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Everyone contacted was advised of the situation and public health risk, as we understood it from the Zoo and Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services, and have either already begun or are on the path to begin prophylaxis, IDPH said in a statement to the Gazette. Linn County Public Health said anyone locally who has been infected has been contacted and the appropriate follow-up has been conducted. Public health officials in Nebraska recommended all campers who stayed at the zoo overnight June 29, June 30, July 2, and July 3 receive prophylaxis. The recommendation came after a camper staying in the aquarium the night of July 3 woke up to a wild bat near her head. A team found seven bats in the building, one of which tested positive for rabies, a news release from the zoo stated. Heather Meter, Linn County Public Health Clinical Supervisor, said public health officials typically recommend anyone sleeping in a room with a wild bat that tests positive for rabies receive the vaccine. Bat bites can be tiny and hard to detect, and there's no cure once someone does develop rabies themselves. For most, the rabies virus will cause death. Some things are a wait-and-see approach, but with this, it's too late if it does develop, Meter said. Unity Point Health, St. Luke's Hospital, administered the rabies vaccine to 27 individuals impacted locally, spokeswoman Sarah Corizo said. Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids also confirmed it was involved with seeing some of these individuals, but did not specify how many. Dr. Tony Myers, Mercy's chief medical officer, said Linn County Public Health helped coordinate the effort to obtain vaccines. Local hospitals keep the rabies vaccine on hand, but the need was significantly larger than our historical use, Corizo said. St. Luke's worked with the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, in addition to local public health, to obtain additional doses. Our team drove down to Iowa City to pick up additional doses and started administering the doses immediately in our pediatric unit, Corizo said. There was no need to secure a rabies vaccine supply from other states, but Iowa Department of Public Health did work closely with Nebraska in case that was needed, officials said in an email to the Gazette. The Henry Dorley Zoo has offered to cover the cost of treatment, the Omaha World-Herald reported. Moving now to the Iowa Today page, Marion's derecho recovery to cost less than initially thought, this story by Gage Miskimen. Marion's cost of recovery from last year's derecho is $11 million less than an earlier estimate. In late January, the city estimated the cost of derecho cleanup would be up to $43 million. This week, a new estimate put the cost at around $32 million, City Manager Lon Plunkin told the Gazette. That's a big positive for the community, Plunkin said. In April, the Marion City Council approved a line of credit of up to $20 million over 4 years with Wells Fargo Bank. The line of credit was there to tide over the city if needed, while it waited for disaster reimbursement from the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the state of Iowa. With the lower cost estimate, city officials are thinking they won't have to borrow any money. It was about that turnaround time for reimbursement, Plunkin said. You never know how quickly you will get it. If things come in by January, we shouldn't have to exercise that line of credit at all. With the damage estimate now at $32 million, Marion will need to come up with around $4.5 million for its share of the cleanup cost instead of $6.5 Marion expects 75% reimbursement from FEMA and 10% from the state. Amal El-Tahir, assistant to the Marion city manager in Marion, previously told the Gazette, a couple of derecho recovery projects already have been completed, including debris collection along public rights-of-way and submitted for reimbursement, Plunkin said. The city had three contracts with Southern Disaster Recovery, Debris Tech Monitoring, and Wendling Quarry for debris collection, monitoring, and disposal, with an estimated total cost of around $30 million. About half that sum goes to Southern Disaster Recovery for cleaning the city's waterways, dry Indian and Wanatee creeks the past few months. Some waterway cleanup remains, mainly on the city's north side and in tributaries to the creeks, though Southern Disaster Recovery finished its portion of the work in June. City workers will complete that work, Plunkin said, noting, "Our flash flooding event in late June could have been worse if we didn't get stuff out of the way." And Iowans should be aware of deadlines for filing derecho damage claims, this story by James Lynch. As the anniversary of the August 10, 2020 derecho approaches, the Iowa Insurance Division encourages Iowans to be aware of deadlines for filing insurance claims and to seek extensions if needed. "We encourage Iowans to continue to work with their insurance company and agent as they move through the insurance claims process to obtain the necessary repairs," Iowa Insurance Commissioner Doug Ullman said. "This can take time as both parties work to come to an understanding about what needs to be fixed and how much it is going to cost. Many Iowans are waiting for work on their homes to be finished, and others are facing shortages of materials and availability of contractors needed to make repairs," Ullman said. "If policyholders find damage from the derecho that was not previously claimed, they likely will need to file an insurance claim as soon as possible because the terms of many insurance policies require claims to be filed within a specific time," he said. Ullman encourages policyholders to read their insurance contracts, document their efforts to get repairs completed, and contact their insurance agent to ensure they are meeting those deadlines. "We have seen insurance carriers willing to grant extensions on a case-by-case basis, given the unique circumstances caused by the derecho. If extensions are needed, a policyholder should speak directly to their agent and insurance company sooner rather than later. If a request for an extension is denied, consumers can file a complaint with the insurance division at https://iid.iowa.gov. And also on the Today page, Finkenauer announces a bid for the U.S. Senate seat. Nearly 7 months out of office, former U.S. Representative Abby Finkenauer still sees a lot to fight for, and this time she hopes to take the fight to the U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley. Finkenauer launched her Democratic campaign Thursday for a return trip to Washington because politicians who've been there for decades don't really want people like us there because they think they own democracy and were silent when it was attacked. She includes Republican Grassley, who hasn't said whether he'll seek an eighth term in 2022, among those entrenched politicians who are, quote, "so obsessed with power that they oppose anything that will move us forward," end quote. "They've turned their backs on democracy," she said in a campaign video. "They made their choice, and I'm making mine." Continuing a theme from her Iowa legislative and congressional campaigns, Finkenauer's Senate campaign focuses on working families, who are oftentimes not heard in Washington. "What's lacking in the nation's capital, among Democrats and Republicans," she said in an interview, "is elected officials, quote, who actually understand working families versus just reading about them," end quote. "When you understand those differences, you understand that there's a difference between the policies in Washington either making sure that you're able to fill your drug prescription that month, or be able to have enough money to be able to take your grandkids out to dinner," Finkenauer said. "It's quite frankly why we're doing this." Grassley's campaign committee said Finkenauer's agenda would allow the federal government to control Iowans' lives with more taxes, regulation, and big government. In what's likely to be a preview of the Grassley campaign strategy, it branded the potential challenger as, quote, "another out-of-touch, out-of-control Democrat too radical for Iowa," end quote. That's why Iowans fired her just last year, giving her the distinction as the first member of Congress from Iowa to lose re-election after just one term in more than 50 years, Grassley committee advisor Jennifer Hines said in a statement. If you know Nancy Pelosi, you know Abby Finkenauer because she voted with Pelosi 93% of the time. Finkenauer joins two other Democrats who want their party's Senate nomination in the statewide race, Manning farmer, cattleman, and former county supervisor Dave Mulbauer, and Glenn Hurst of Minden. Finkenauer said special interests who disagreed with her votes to raise wages, strengthen labor unions, and reduce the price of prescription drugs spent millions of dollars, in my case, $5 million, to defeat her. Former state legislator Ashley Hinson returned the Northeast Iowa's 1st District to Republican control when she defeated Finkenauer in 2020. Saying a year is plenty of time for a campaign, Grassley, who has held elective office since 1959, plans to announce in October or November whether he'll run again. That guy's ready to roll, Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman recently said about Grassley, noting Grassley has more than $2.5 million in his campaign account. In 2020, roughly $234 million was spent on the U.S. Senate campaign that featured Republican Senator Joni Ernst and Democrat challenger Teresa Greenfield. I just feel incredibly confident in Chuck Grassley against anyone, to be honest with you, Kaufman said. Facing Finkenauer wouldn't be a political walk in the park, but I'm telling you that I probably wouldn't wear the full suit of armor. Iowa Democratic Party Chairman State Representative Ross Wilburn said, "Iowans are done with Chuck Grassley. They've seen his recent actions and know that he's turned into the Washington insider he used to claim to fight against." Also on today's Iowa Today page, this story by Marissa Payne. Cedar Rapids Citizens Police Review Board meets for the first time. The nine members appointed to the city's newly created Citizens Police Review Board said at their first meeting Thursday they envision their work building stronger bridges between law enforcement officials and the community they serve for generations to come. The panel, born of the Advocates for Social Justice's seven demands for local police reform, after the murder last year of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, convened for the first time to discuss the legacy members hope the board will leave, review bylaws and training requirements, and settle other logistics like scheduling. Members selected Star Smith and India Snow Watt as chair and vice chair, respectively. As a black woman with friends who are officers, Smith said she's excited about being a bridge builder involved in connecting police and the community. "What I hope and what I envision is this will become a rock, a foundation of just that bridge to make sure that there is a really good relationship built between the community and law enforcement," Smith told the Gazette. Cedar Rapids Police Sergeant Laura Faircloth shared with members more details about training they would undergo in their first year on the panel, as set by the police department. It will include structure of the police department, constitutional law, Bill of Rights, state and local law, use of force, evolution and policies, de-escalation training, mental health team, force options, firearms and weapons systems, hands-on defense tactics, driving, and professional standards. Members also will develop a process for overseeing complaints against officers and will develop a public outreach program which must include holding one forum. Toward the end of the board's first operational year, City Program Manager April Wing, the staff liaison to the board, reminded members they will do some long-term planning. "What is it that you guys hope to accomplish or hope for the CRB to accomplish within the next 5 years or so?" While Smith said there's no way to know where the community will be in 10 years, she hopes this board, once members are trained and understand more what it means to be a police officer, will provide accountability, strengthen community relationships, and ensure residents feel their voices are heard. Several board members emphasized hoping this panel's work would make the community better for today's children and to create a sense of belonging and inclusion for all. that this board grew out of a protest against racial injustice and police brutality is a good thing, Smith said. Everything that happened, there's a lot of people who feel like their voices are not heard, Smith said. I think this will give them that opportunity to be able to share their voice and to actually have those that are in charge of our city listen. And they're listening. Their ears are open wide. Mayor Brad Hart thanked the members for their service. He said the training will be critical to members' work. Our police department will be more effective, solve more crimes, and that benefits every one of us, Hart said. The board's next meeting is slated for August 19. Meetings will be held in person with a virtual option. Moving now to the Insight page, the Gazette's own editorial is titled Available Spat in CR Mayoral Race. A dust-up involving Mayor Brad Hart, CSPS, and mayoral candidate Amara Andrews hit the front page last weekend. It gave us a glimpse into the tensions bubbling up from a competitive mayoral race that are certain to make more headlines as the campaign moves toward fall. Andrews was set to be a special guest at an improv event at the CSPS Hall. It was not a campaign event, and CSPS included a disclaimer on materials promoting the event, confirming its political neutrality as a 501c3 nonprofit organization. But Andrews promoted the event on her campaign's Facebook page. Hart caught wind of that promotion and left an angry voicemail message for CSPS Executive Director Taylor Bergen. The mayor argued that Andrews' participation would jeopardize the arts organization's nonprofit status and city funding to CSPS through the hotel motel tax. It's complete bullshit, and if you don't know that you have violated your 501c3 status, you should not be in the role you're in, Hart said, according to a report by the Gazette's Marissa Payne. CSPS canceled the event. Hart stood by his legal claim that the event would be inappropriate, but later apologized on Facebook for not delivering his message in a more calm way. Andrews held the improv event at another location. Everybody could have done better. Andrews made a mistake in promoting the event on her campaign Facebook page, giving it the air of a political event that CSPS specifically sought to avoid. CSPS and its partner should have steered clear of hosting and promoting an event with only one mayoral candidate in a three-person field. Improvisation shouldn't extend to following the rules set out for nonprofits. Still, Hart's response to the situation was way out of line. He's the one with actual power, and he aggressively threatened to wield it against a political foe. Hart's threat that the event would have a bearing on CSPS's city funding was particularly jarring. It smacked of politically motivated retribution and was entirely inappropriate. Hart's much stronger case that the event ran afoul of rules barring political activity and should not be held was undermined by this angry warning. The election is still 3 months away. We understand this is a contest between candidates who are very active in the community, including work with nonprofits. It's a race for a part-time position, so cutting all ties isn't feasible. But there are rules that must be followed, so the candidates should take care to avoid conflicts of interest and putting nonprofits in an uncomfortable, perhaps illegal, position. How they handle their campaigns and moments of tension will tell a lot about what sort of mayor they'll be. Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column today is titled Little to be Done About Fireworks. The greatest minds in local elected office came together last week to talk about what they see as a pressing issue, the scourge of illegal fireworks throughout Johnson County in July. The discussion took place at a joint entities meeting, bringing together city, school, and county electeds from across the area. Usually at these meetings, attendees give short updates on their projects and move along with much back and forth. On fireworks, though, they had plenty to say. Iowa City Council member John Thomas led the discussion. He worried there were weak links in enforcement in the county, where in most places it's already illegal by local ordinance to shoot fireworks at any time. Thomas proposed some kind of regional agreement where authorities would switch from educating scofflaws to writing tickets by a certain point at night. Part of the concern I'm hearing is it just seemed unrelenting. It's not just small-scale fireworks, but what I would call almost commercial fireworks, Thomas said. The agenda setters at the meeting apparently didn't invite local law enforcement to weigh in on the issue. But Sheriff Brad Kunkel, hearing about the meeting earlier that day, raised his virtual hand on the Zoom video conference and was given the chance to speak. Whatever spark the local officials had for ramping up fireworks enforcement, Kunkel quickly extinguished it. There are several challenges to fireworks enforcement, the sheriff explained. For one, with everything else going on around July 4, fireworks calls are not a priority. Even if officers have time to investigate a fireworks complaint, they can rarely determine for sure who the perpetrator is. And even if they settle on a suspect and write a ticket, government attorneys have to spend their limited resources to prosecute cases. For your law enforcement agencies, these are probably, like I said, low-priority calls, and they still wind up being difficult to enforce because we literally need to essentially see that person lighting that fuse, and if there's three people standing there and nobody saw anything, there's not much we can do about it, Kunkel said. The folks in the anti-fireworks lobby sound kind of like fishers recounting their catches. Each of the past few years around Independence Day, the fireworks seem to get louder and more frequent and go later and later into the night. In reality, calls to police about fireworks were down this year. Maybe the problem isn't actually getting worse, or maybe concerned citizens have resigned themselves to it. Whatever the case, council members are prioritizing a problem with no good policy solution. They could advocate to repeal the state law allowing fireworks sales, although Johnson County officials don't have much clout in Des Moines, and it would fly in the face of the local control kick they've been on. Fortunately, some in local government are coming around to the right conclusion, that we can't rely on police officers to address all our problems. We're trying to be very cognizant of not being an entity that is telling neighbors to, you know, call the cops on their neighbors, Swisher Mayor Chris Taylor said. And one community letter today penalizing farmers divides us over water quality. Recent pieces on water quality controversies by Aaron Jordan, July 9, and Todd Dorman, July 15, describe key divisions and denials, but they leave out huge factors ignored by all players mentioned that are needed for any effective resolution. What's missing is that the problems stem from the penalization of Iowa's farmers through the reduction and elimination of the core farm programs, those that set a floor under market prices. This has forced farmers to massively subsidize with cheap grain the loss of almost all of their value-added livestock to CAFOs, leading to huge losses of sustainability of grass, alfalfa, and oats, and of the infrastructure to support these systems. As a result, the major farm prices have been below full cost most of the time since 1981. And median net farm income has been below zero almost every year since the 1990s. Surviving farmers have relied more and more on off-farm income. That led to less labor and more capitalization, helping agribusiness but hurting the environment. This is the key missing data. It divides us. The Dorman piece refers to agriculture credentials, how agriculture lobbies and wealthy agriculture interests. He confuses the interests of farmers with those of agribusiness. The agribusiness lobbyists with the GOP lawmakers have been anti-farmer for decades, against fair prices and therefore against livestock and diversity. And that is signed by Brad Wilson from Springville. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Friday, July 23, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices from Cedar Rapids, Edna Dory Larson, age 93, died Wednesday, July 21. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service. In Cedar Rapids, Stephen J. Ovell, age 73, died Wednesday, July 21. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. In Iowa City, Foster Gail Baker, age 97, died Wednesday, July 21. The Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City is assisting. Also in Iowa City, Lona Ray Forrest, age 90, died Monday, July 19. Again, Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. From Ossian, Reverend Philip Olson, age 73, died Wednesday, July 21. Schluter Balick Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting. In Stanwood, Neil Smith, age 81, died Thursday, July 22nd. The Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence is in charge. From West Branch, Dalen Thomas Peterson, age 19, died Tuesday, July 20. Henderson Barker Funeral Home, West Branch. And in Wheatland, Leila Dittmer, age 93, died Thursday, July 22nd. Chapman Funeral Home, Clarence. Moving now to the regular notices, just three obituaries for today. First, from Iowa City, Barbara Jane Levitinsky Spiker, age 78, died Wednesday, July 21st. Funeral services will be held Monday, July 26th at 2 p.m. at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m. prior to the service. Burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery. A memorial fund has been established in her memory. From Hopkinton, Marilyn Kirkwood, age 89, died Wednesday, July 21, at the Good Neighbor Society, Manchester. Visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, July 25, at Getch Funeral Home, Monticello. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, July 26, at the Hopkinton Community Church, where friends may call after 10 a.m. Interment was in the Hopkinton Cemetery. In lieu of the increasing COVID numbers, the family requests that all visitors, vaccinated or not, wear masks for the visitation and the funeral. The family suggests that in lieu of flowers, memorials be made to the Hopkinton Fire Department or the Hopkinton Ambulance Service. And lastly, from Toddville, Richard Allen Blessing, age 80, died at home on Wednesday, July 21. The family suggests that friends celebrate Richard's life in a manner that is comforting to them and reminds them of Richard's life work. TN Funeral Home and Cremation is serving the family. Memorials may be directed to the donor's charity of choice. Online condolences may be left at the TN Funeral Home website. Moving now to the sports page, state softball tournament news, Class 2A championship, another run to glory for the Lynx, this by Jeff Linder. When Chad Spohr was hired as softball coach at North Lynn High School last fall, he was hesitant to utter the phrase state championship. "I wanted to prepare them to compete at the state tournament," Spohr said, "but I didn't want to set them up for failure. So I didn't say anything about championships." He can now. All-tournament captain Skylar Benish doubled home Olivia Rauch at the bottom of the fifth inning for the game's lone run, then followed that with a spectacular catch in the field to lead second-ranked North Lynn past number 7 Earlham in the Class 2A title game 1-0 last night at the Rogers Sports Complex. "I'm so happy for the whole team," said Benish. "A freshman, we did this for each other." North Lynn, 42-6, won its second 2A title in 3 years. The Lynx captured the 2019 title under Marv Porter, then settled for second place last year. With several key players graduating after the 2020 season, this appeared to be a summer of transition. Hardly, instead, was another run to glory. Benish, who was 7-for-11 in the three games here this week, was one of five North Lynn players on the all-tournament unit. She was joined by pitcher Ellie Flanagan, who blanked the Cardinals 34-10 on four hits, along with Rauch, Jill Smith, and Caitlin Sommerfeldt. The Lynx had scored 13 runs in their first two games of the state tournament. Earlham had tallied 16, so the last thing anyone could have expected was a 1-0 pitcher's duel. "I thought we were going to come out better with our bats," Smith said. "We didn't string our hits together, but it all worked out." The Lynx had just two hits through the first four innings, but Rauch led off the bottom of the fifth with a single, then came all the way around to score on Benish's deep drive to straightaway center. "I wanted us to be the first team on the board," Benish said. "I wanted to go up to the plate calm and relaxed." Shortly after Benish giveth, Benish taketh away. Earlham threatened in the sixth with runners at second and third and one out. Alexis Voss hit a rocket to the left side, but Benish jumped to her right to rob her. "I saw it off the bat and I thought, I have a chance to go get this ball," Benish said. "I was able to jump up and get it." Flanagan got Allison Beatty to hit a ground ball back to the circle and threw her out to drench the threat. "Benish saved us 1, 2, maybe 3 runs this game," Spohr said. After yielding 5 runs in the semifinals, Flanagan was sharp Thursday. She struck out only 3, but her team made plays behind her, both routine and not so routine. Earlham had a runner at third base in the first, second, and sixth innings, but each time Flanagan made key pitches. "She was lights out tonight," Spohr said. And in Class 1A, Newell Fonda denies Lisbon. This story also by Jeff Linder. For the Lisbon Lions, last night's Class 1A state championship contest evolved into a game of inches and ifs. "In the field, we just missed some outstanding tries for the ball," Coach Bob Bunting said. "We hit 4 hard shots to left field. If those are gappers, it's a completely different game." Instead, it was a 4-1 decision for top-ranked Newell Fonda at the Rogers Sports Complex. "We were so close on some of those plays," outfielder Kaylee Nelson said. "They didn't go our way today. Someday they will." Fourth-rated Lisbon, 37-9, has gotten here 4 years in a row, finishing 3rd, 3rd, 4th, and 2nd. "We wanted to make our community proud," Nelson said. "This was a big accomplishment, even though it didn't finish the way we wanted. But we'll be back." Newell Fonda pitcher Kiera Jungers was the all-tournament captain after limiting the Lions to 3 hits, none after the 4th inning. "She had a good rise ball," Lisbon's Peyton Robinson said. "A lot of girls couldn't see it very well. It happens." Long, a small school basketball giant, the Mustangs, 38-4, cashed in on their 14th softball appearance for their second title. The other was in 2008. "Being at state every year, I think it takes a lot of pressure," Newell Fonda Bailey Seaver said. "It gave us the ability to stay calm." The Mustangs broke a 1-1 tie in the bottom of the fourth when 2 loopers to the Lisbon outfield barely evaded diving attempts by the Lions outfielders. The first was by Sophie Stewart, a single that put runners at first and second with one out. The second came by number 9 Mia Walker, a 2-run double that put Newell Fonda ahead to stay at 3-1. Mary Walker's RBI single in the fifth provided an insurance run. Newell Fonda scored an unearned run in the first inning, then the Lions briefly tied 1-1 in the top of the fourth. Mia Peterson walked, moved to second on Ella Clark's sacrifice bunt, advanced to third on Riley Allgood's groundout, and scored on Nelson's infield single. Nelson, Robinson, and Allgood represented Lisbon on the all-tournament team. All 3 are sophomores. "We lose 3 seniors, and they're going to be missed," Robinson said. "But we've still got our pitcher, and we've still got a lot of players coming back, and we've still got Bunting." On deck today and on television on Iowa Public TV, the Class 3A final will be aired at 2:30 p.m., Class 4A final at 5 p.m., and the Class 5A final will be aired live at 7:30. On the radio, Major League Baseball has the Diamondbacks at the Cubs at 1 p.m., the Twins versus the Angels at 6:30. On the Business 380 page, back to school shopping is returning. About 3/4 of U.S. shoppers plan to do back to school shopping in stores this year. In a Bloomberg News story, the latest sign that consumer behavior is normalizing after the long pandemic isolation. While the bulk of consumers aren't shying away from stores, more than half said they will do at least some of their shopping online, according to a survey released Thursday from Sensormatic Solutions, the data provider owned by Johnson Controls International. The report polled 1,000 shoppers in mid-June, so the findings don't fully capture the impact of the latest COVID-19 surge caused by the Delta variant. After more than a year of pandemic-related challenges, retailers are hoping heading into the critical shopping season as many parents prepare to send their children back to in-person classes. Vaccination rates have helped ease consumer anxieties. 73% of respondents said they were neutral or unconcerned about in-store shopping, up from just 35% in late 2020. Shopper hesitancy isn't the only hurdle during the back-to-school season. Port delays and labor shortages are threatening to slow the arrival of produce to stores. Clothing, a category that suffered during pandemic lockdowns last year, was the product that consumers expect to spend the most on this year, followed by shoes and school supplies. Asking consumers how they plan to shop this year, the study found 76% said they will shop in stores, 54% plan to shop online, 33% expect to use buy online, then pick up in store, and 22% will use curbside pickup. Also on the Business 380 page, this AP story, pork producer year-round migrants needed. A top Iowa pork producer is pushing federal lawmakers to allow immigrant workers to stay on the job year-round. A spokesman for Iowa Select Farms, the state's largest pork producer, told U.S. senators during a Senate Judiciary Committee meeting Wednesday, that seasonal employment currently allowed under a federal visa program is insufficient to meet the industry's needs, the Des Moines Register reported. Farmers and meatpacking plants are facing severe labor shortages and need migrant workers to be able to work year-round, spokeswoman Jen Sorensen said. If the labor shortage is not addressed, it could lead to farms and packing plants shutting down, causing serious financial harms to the communities in which they operate, said Sorensen, who's also president of the National Pork Producers Council. Wednesday's hearing focused on the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which would provide a pathway to legal status for more than 1 million undocumented farm workers. The U.S. passed the bill in March. The U.S. House passed the bill in March. Iowa's U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley and U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, a former Iowa governor, also testified at the hearing. While Sorensen praised the legislation's call for year-round visas, she urged lawmakers to lift its cap on the number of those visas, saying that would force producers to compete against one another for the same limited number of year-round visas. In the Living section today, this story by Barbara Quinn for the Monterey Herald from California is titled, "Will Skipping Red Meat Help Global Warming?" I keep coming upon this statistic that states livestock are responsible for 14.5% of global gas emissions. Some designate ruminant animals, cows, sheep, and goats, as the biggest contributors to greenhouse gases. Others then go on to offer a solution: switch from beef and lamb to pork and chicken, and consume fewer dairy products. Not everyone agrees with that conclusion, including Dr. Frank Miltoner, professor and air quality expert at the University of California at Davis. Foregoing meat is not the environmental panacea many would have us believe, he said. Here are some of his reasons. It's true that around the world, cattle are the number one agricultural source of greenhouse gases, says Miltonhauer. That's where the prevailing statistics of 14.5% emissions from cattle comes from. It's a different story in the United States, where cows and other ruminants account for just 4% of all greenhouse gases produced. Beef cattle specifically are responsible for 2% of direct emissions, he said. What is the source, then, of the higher greenhouse gas emissions from cattle in the rest of the world? India is one hot spot, said Miltoner. That country has more cattle than anywhere else on Earth, yet the lowest consumption of beef. As a result, cows live longer and emit more methane over their lifetime. In addition, cows in tropical regions produce less milk and meat, so it takes them longer to get to market, said Miltoner. On the U.S. side, better animal breeding, genetics, and nutrition have increased the efficiency of livestock production. We're feeding more people with fewer cattle, which creates a much smaller carbon footprint, he said. That conclusion is backed up by the EPA. They report that all of agriculture to produce food in the U.S. accounts for 10% of greenhouse gas emissions. Transportation contributes 29%. Electricity, 25%, and industry, 23%. This is not an argument to make everyone a meat eater. Our human diet varies from person to person and culture to culture. What doesn't vary are the basic nutrient needs of every human on this planet, and as our world population grows, the importance of all types of agriculture will become more and more apparent. That means we need a system that is not only good for the environment, but sustainable for the long term. I invite you to read at www.ucdavis.edu/food/news/making cattle more sustainable. Turning now to the living section. No excuses, Cedar Rapids man has never missed his daily workout for the last 27 years. This story by Elijah Desius. Though Mark Mueller said he hasn't missed a daily workout in 27 years, he doesn't consider himself to be an unusual person. He just takes things one day at a time. We all have it in us. It's just what you decide to do, Mueller said. Counting back to February 21, 1994, one day at a time has added up to more than 10,000 consecutive days, according to his stack of notebooks with meticulous details on each day's workout. The first of those notebooks, before Mueller says his consecutive streak began, goes back to the 70s, when he was still in high school. Scraps of paper before that are still sitting around recording push-up contest results with his brother as a kid. Days take themselves off. You don't need to take days off, Mueller said. The things you've got planned for the day sometimes don't get done because unexpected things arise in the day. It's why I work out every morning in case something does come up. He's followed that mantra ever since he stayed out too late one night and felt guilty after missing the next day's exercise. Now, after every morning workout, even if nothing else happens that day, he has accomplished something. I consider a workout an accomplishment. Even a bad workout beats the heck out of no workout, he said. I don't want to have regrets because I don't get today back. And unlike watching TV, working out is something he never regrets. Thanks to the routine the Trinity Lutheran School principal has devised, he doesn't need to take a day off from working out, something he considers a bit more intense than routine or recreational exercise. Working out twice each day, Mueller alternates routines, either running in the morning and biking in the evening, or swimming in the morning and lifting weights in the afternoon. Each routine works out different parts of the body, giving the rest of the body time to recuperate. It just doesn't feel right if I'm not working out, he said. Something's missing. Walking pneumonia, a knee issue, and even COVID-19 earlier this year has never been an excuse for Mueller to stop. It was just a chance to switch up his routine. Short of death, the 65-year-old said nothing will stop him from continuing. His son, Taylor Mueller, said it started with the motivation of never wanting to see his gut when he looked down. Once he starts something, he sees it through, Taylor said. He doesn't want to break the streak. But after 27 years, his intestinal fortitude is self-evident. Now it's such a natural part of his day that it feels unnatural to pause, even for a day. The son of a minor league baseball pitcher, fitness and exercise has been running in the family since day one. When my father would come home and say, "Do you guys want to play?" It wasn't really, "Do you want to?" It was, "We're going to," Mueller said. It was always a baseball workout. After playing baseball his freshman and sophomore year of high school, a back injury kept him from being able to swing a bat. Instead, he came back swinging with track and cross country. In his senior year at Jefferson High School, he ran 9:22.8 in the 3,200-meter run, a record for the school at the time, according to Mueller. "A lot of that was plain hard work," he said. Mueller didn't start with the goal of hitting 10,000 days. Early on in his streak, he simply wanted to hit the next 1,000. Some days, it was the streak that kept him going. Now his goal is simply to get to 11,000 on April 4, 2024. While a lot of his motivation was originally preparing for road races, the color-coded stacks of handwritten records are proof that even in his 60s, he hasn't lost much ground. "I've proven to myself I actually did this," he said, "that I'm capable of more than I give myself credit for. Too often, I've sold myself short." In his workout notebooks, he includes details down to the temperature and weather conditions of each day. Green ink represents growth. Black represents what he actually did. Red usually represents injuries, and blue gives some general information. Each page notes his cumulative day number and how far he has run up to that point in the year. Even for the non-athletic, there's a lesson to be learned. You're capable of more than you realize, and you have at least one gift of strength you can develop. Mueller said his gift isn't working out or being athletic, it's being driven and self-disciplined, something he said God uses as an opportunity to connect him with others. For the basketball players he coaches at Trinity Lutheran, it gives credibility by showing the kids that he puts the work in himself, too. But more than pride in an accomplishment, he said he's simply grateful to be able to have done this for so long. "I'm just grateful I can still be doing what I'm doing," Mueller said. Finishing up with the top weather story, this by meteorologist Kai O'Meara. As we've worked through this week, the heat and humidity have been slowly building. In fact, Thursday was the second consecutive day of 70-plus dew points, hence the sweltering feeling in the air. From a temperature standpoint, though, it really isn't too far off the normal for this time of year. You'd tend to expect some 90s in July, and we average about 6 days' worth in any given year. Occasionally, we'll see much more. Some years, we'll see less. Look for hot temperatures to go well into next week. Some storms may break the heat at times. The humidity will be up as well. Stay cool. Cedar Rapids, you're looking for a high today of 90 and a low of 72. Iowa City, 91 and a low of 72. Chances of storms tomorrow, very humid conditions. Partly cloudy again Sunday and Monday. We're in a full moon phase with moon rise at 8:49 p.m. and moon set at 6:08 a.m. Sunset tonight is at 8:34 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow at 5:52 a.m. We have 14 hours and 43 minutes of daylight. Normal high and low for today are 85 for the high and 64 for the low. Record high was set in 1901 at 104 degrees, and the record low of 44 was set in 1925. And that does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.